John Freeman is the editor of Freeman's, a literary biannual, and author of two books of nonfiction, The Tyranny of Email and How to Read a Novelist. He also has edited two anthologies of writing on inequality, Tale of Two Cities and Tale of Two Americas. The former editor of Granta, he lives in New York, where he teaches at the New School and is a writer in residence at NYU. The executive editor at Lit Hub, he has published poems in Zizova, The New Yorker, The Paris Review, The Nation. His work has been translated into more than 20 languages. He was on the show with me in 2015 talking about Tale of Two Cities. You can access that podcast on our website. But today we are talking all about poetry, the craft of poetry, the process of poetry, and John's incredible debut collection. It is called Maps. It's published by Copper Canyon Press, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. John, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So I'm ashamed to admit, after, you know, stalked you on Facebook and followed you in your many literary adventures and having you on the show, I didn't realize you were a poet until recently. So.
Yeah, the nice thing about being a poet is you can often hide in plain sight.
So have you been at this all the way along?
Yes and no. You know, you mentioned that this is on college radio, so anyone out there still smarting from the wound of being unaccepted to their college workshop, I wrote poetry until I was about 19, and then I applied to my college workshop, didn't get in, and then promptly didn't write it for 12 years or so, because I just assumed if I couldn't even get into my college workshop, I wasn't really a poet. I read poetry, and then eventually life circumstances forced me back to it, where I just felt like I needed to say something in a form that had the kind of pressure in it or on it, on the language that I felt in my life.
I was wondering as I read this, because I could feel echoes of some of the fiction and some of the nonfiction that you've read echoed in your poetry. And, you know, I kind of wondered if the two were in somehow either content conversation with each other, or if this was another way to get at some of the material you were trying to get at in some of your anthologies.
Well, to be honest, I was going to write a book about suburbia, a kind of elegy to suburbia. It's where I grew up, and it was the language of childhood to me, the kind of cul-de-sacs and the endless track homes and the kind of strange disembodiment of growing up in a suburb that seems like it could be anywhere, with streets named after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And it seemed strange to me, to be honest, that lots of America grew up that way too, in these kind of ideal manufactured communities, with lawns pumped full of chemicals and, you know, planting seasons that ran 300 days of the year, at least in California, where I grew up. And when I went to go start doing the research, I realized there were a lot of books about the end of suburbia, quote-unquote, which is a really misnomer. There is no end to suburbia. It just means that different populations are living there who are not white. And the suburbs in the United States were originally all-white communities. And so I realized that I didn't want to write the book that I had set out to write. But I started to write these poems because sometimes if you want to bounce off something, a poem is the perfect device because you can create an atmosphere and then wind up somewhere else.
Did you, tell me about kind of the course over which these poems were written. Have these kind of been a life collection of work, or have these come about, you know, in the last recent decade or so?
I would say it's a decade.
Okay.
And they started, frankly, when my mother got sick and started to have symptoms of dementia. And I just didn't know how to deal with it, to be honest. And, you know, there's lots and lots of poems about grief and mourning. And I just found that I sat down and I wrote a poem one day. And I was lucky to have a friend who was a published poet and who had mourned and some of his own family members in poems as well. And we had already been meeting semi-regularly in New York at a cafe that still exists called Cafe Dante, talking about poetry, because he's a lawyer and all he really cares about outside of the law is poetry. Mm-hmm. And so one day I brought him a poem and he said it was decent. And so I kept going. And that was all the encouragement I needed. And he was an incredible friend and kind of teacher to me as I began to feel my way back into poetry.
It's interesting because I have found in, you know, whatever state the world has found itself in the last year or so, getting worse, that I find myself more and more drawn to poetry. And as we have all these discussions about truth and fake news and what is real and, you know, and our, you know, kind of perceptions of reality are challenged, the poem seems like kind of the most true place you can still go to. And it's beautiful and it captures something, you know, kind of in its purest essence. And I don't know if this is the case, but I feel like a lot of people have been going back to poetry in the last year as sort of a salve or something.
Well, I mean, it is the news that stays news, as Ezra Pound, I think, put it. And I think we also are beginning to realize that all the things that declared themselves to be true, be it journalism or the words of governments, are often lying to us. And I think, you know, there's a new way of telling the truth, which is an old way, which is to say it in the fewest words possible. And poetry does that better than any other genre. And I think because poetry can evoke a feeling with more efficiency than I think any other written genre, it sticks to people. And so, you know, if there's a reason why people don't read excerpts of novels at weddings. They read poems. You know, they read poems at funerals. They read poems on occasions. It's the kind of intensity of the form that people gravitate towards. And in a world of competing and kind of endless intensities, whether it's the news or you know, the climate change or just the seeming apocalypse that is unfolding around us, the intensities of poetry are warm and welcoming, and
yeah.
They're a place. They're like a, you know, an awning that you can stand under in the middle of the storm. And the nice thing is, it's big enough for more than one person to stand under. And I think friends I know are, you know, sharing poems constantly now. Recently, it was sort of a jag of people all passing back and forth. Allen Ginsberg's Wichita Sutra Vortex, which is one of his poems from the mid-60s about the Vietnam War and trying to reclaim language from the language of war. He has this great line that says, all our language is taxed by war.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of us feel that way right now, that the language that we use in everyday life has been pre-taxed by all the things that we sort of resist. And so poetry is one very effective way to reclaim that language.
As you're saying that, I'm reminded of Paul Celan, who was a Holocaust poet, who said how painful it was to write in his native tongue of German because it was, you know, the tongue of the Nazis and it was, you know, the tongue of the people who, you know, persecuted his family. And as you're saying that, there's echoes of that things are tainted or taxed. I love.
Well, a lot of Paul Celan has been coming up a lot right now for the same reason. You know, poets who basically had to survive in the middle of terrible assaults, not just on language but on the bodies of people, and the two are not the same. You know, language is the body of literature, but the body of people comes first. And I think in the last couple of years we've seen. A terrible spectacle of violence written upon the body, you know, whether it's African Americans in this country being shot by police or protesters elsewhere or people standing in the way of the rising tide of climate change, be it in Haiti or Puerto Rico. And there's a kind of gleefulness at the center of it all, I think, that is part of our dialectic culture now. It was a tweeter in chief that just feels sinister.
Yeah.
And so when those feelings, which I think a lot of people have that are listening to this program, reach a kind of breaking point, I just turn off the news and open a book of poems,
mm-hmm.
which seems escapist, but it's not, because to me it's escaping back into the truth.
Mm-hmm. My guest this morning is John Freeman. The collection of poetry is called Maps. So let's get into the collection a little bit. I'll give you a chance to introduce it, but it's told in three parts. There's a lot of war, destruction, and construction, and there's a lot of love and a lot of grief. But I'll let you kind of take us into it and kind of tell us about your organizing principles and kind of the territory, the maps of what the book covers.
Yeah, it took me a bit to realize that maps was the organizing metaphor. As I mentioned, that some of this book is mourning and grieving and remembering my mother, but I didn't want that to be the only thing about the book. And as I began to write more poems, I realized what I was concerned with or curious about, I guess possessed by, was the desire to map experience onto the world and show how the world and places I had been had mapped themselves onto me. And I think there are two kinds of maps. Robert McFarlane writes about this in The Wild Places. There's the grid map, which is just a set of coordinates. And I think to some degree our world structurally is run by those coordinates, the data coordinates, the map coordinates of nationality, the coordinates of economics and markets. And then there's the subjective map, the map that includes all the elements of culture and experience that define, I think, human life beyond those other grid coordinates. And I wanted to write poems that were about that second kind of map, because I think the first kind of map sometimes enables empire, enables projections. It enables the kinds of things that allow, I think, war to happen or make it easier, because it's just a grid map. It's not a map of people with experiences. And I think growing up in the United States, there's a special responsibility, because we are the most powerful nation on earth, and we have the widest empire and the most and terrible military might, and we've used it continuously throughout the last 70 years. Sometimes, as we say, for good, but you know, there's been a lot of other instances. And so I wanted to write about all those things together, because to me they're inseparable: the pleasures of places, the memories of people, and the maps of empire. I can't pull them apart.
Mm-hmm. Have you spent time in all of the particular spots that the poems touch down?
Yeah, I didn't feel like I could write about them otherwise. You know, there is one poem called "The Bomb Shelters of Oligarchs," mm-hmm. and it mentions one place, which is the Holland Park. But there is no secret dumb waiter that goes below to a bomb shelter owned by oligarchs. But everything else was real.
That was so compelling. The images here are so compelling. Is that kind of the way that you get drawn into a poem, is through a particular image? Or
in that case, it was one image, in that a billionaire whom I knew had given her husband a Bentley for his 50th birthday, and he never drove it because he was embarrassed by it. and it was a perfect 1969 Bentley convertible. And so it just sat there and accumulated value. And then I thought about all the other things that sort of were accumulating value, not just in their lives, but in the lives of lots of other billionaires. And like many billionaires, they also had people working for them who had truly terrifying stories, you know, the kind of low blink rate that you associate with people who experience trauma. Hmm. And I just basically kind of associated outward from that and tried to imagine, because I was in London at the time, just all the store of wealth that was hiding in places, sometimes in plain sight. London, as you might know, has one of the most expensive apartment buildings in the world, and most of it is empty because it's just simply a place for the ultra, ultra rich to park their wealth in the event that, you know, they need to leave whatever country they're in and retrieve it. It's sitting there in the form of real estate in London. Hmm. And I think that's a terrible thing, because if wealth is just an abstract value, then it's simply riches. But as we know, wealth is usually the accumulated value that's come from the labor of other people. Mm-hmm. So when you see a 1969 Bentley convertible that's probably worth tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, sitting there idle, it's like the lives of several people. And that sort of repulsed me.
Mm-hmm. Has your mind always worked like this? I mean, your mind itself, as you're talking, is poetic. And I just wonder if you almost think people are born poets. I feel like there are some people that could sit there for their entire lives and with a gun to their head, and they'd never be able to.
No, I can assure you, I spent a lot of my time reading the box scores of Sacramento Bee growing up and memorizing how many rebounds Otis Thorpe had. And I think the associative logic of poetry was something that I had to kind of relearn. I didn't appreciate as much growing up, when I was reading the Beats, what the power of associative logic was and the way it could connect unlike things with unlike things and make patterns that were not perhaps apparent in public life, but were to some degree maybe even the pattern that defined, I don't know, the way that violence moves through a society. And I think poets have a better chance of identifying those things, because sometimes if you lay out the patterns of, say, violence in American culture, they tend to move in unexpected ways, and their improbability makes them hard to both define and, I think, identify, because it makes you sound like a conspiracist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that all of the patterns are like that. Some are quite direct. You know, the pattern from, say, I don't know, the 13th Amendment to the prison industrial complex is a very direct and easy to follow pattern. But other patterns, I think, are almost metaphoric. And one of the appeals to me of poetry is the chance to have a form that can sustain that sort of association.
I was going to say, one of the things that I marveled at in a lot of these poems is your use of, as you say, juxtaposing two ideas to create a third wholly new idea that's either an epiphany or is ironic or, you know, is revelatory in some other way. And you do that both in content, in the meanings of the words, and I feel like you also do that in the sounds of the words, that there are no obvious rhymes, but the rhymes are embedded kind of inside the word and meter of the word themselves. I mean, I guess that's what poetry is, but it's it just struck me again and again in a lot of these poems that you're
Yeah, for a while I was trying to use end rhymes, but it tends to create a sort of almost Dr. Seuss sounding rhythm.
Yeah.
And I ended up by sometimes accident. I was using internal rhymes. I ended up using internal rhymes rather than end rhymes because I thought it was something that was more unexpected.
Yeah, right. Actually, I had written. It's funny you used the word accident. I now can't find in my notes where I had it written down, but. That was, in fact, one of the words. Oh, scattering happens, accident is in this poem on love. And you're right. That's a great example of it's almost the internal sounds of the word rather than the consonants at the end of the word. It's the vowels of the word that are rhyming rather than the consonants. And it's really lovely for the ear. I mean, it really sounds subconsciously pleasurable, I think. Great.
Yeah, thank you. Sometimes you're absolutely right. It just happened by accident. And I, the only thing I can credit for that is, you know, I spent 20 years reviewing books, and increasingly my ear is internal because I'm spending so much time reading silently. And it's sort of strange, isn't it, that you can read a book that you know sounds beautiful, but you can hear it in your head silently while reading it without ever having read it aloud.
I do wonder that if you can almost teach yourself, I mean, it must occur over time because writers aren't in school their whole lives, that you teach yourself to write by reading and by being around great literature. But, you know, it's striking me that when you applied for a program in your younger years and didn't get in, and then you moved to the phase where someone told you that your work was, I forget what the word you used was, but it was funny, adequate or... not terrible. I forget what your friend said. That strikes me as so funny now because, you know, what has emerged is so gorgeous and beautiful that, I guess we teach ourselves through all the reading and writing that we do over time that our brain just trains itself to think poetically, think beautifully.
It took a while, though. I mean, to be honest, the one, I think the oldest poem in here it's called Still Life. It was a poem that I'm really grateful Ziziva took. It was the poem I showed to my friend, and it was just a very brief poem. And I was thinking about the fact that my mother spent a lot of her time as a kind of advocate for pain, as a social worker, measuring the stories of people and putting them into patient notes. At in the dark of night, you know, often while we were sleeping. And meanwhile, this sort of disease that was probably already beginning to make itself known in her body was creeping up on her. And it felt, frankly, a little bit like a horror story. And I had this thought before I wrote it down in a very abstract way. And so the poem itself is kind of like one scene. It's really one juxtaposition. And I got in and out of it kind of as quickly as possible because I didn't want to ruin it.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I think the first dozen or two dozen poems I was writing and showing to this friend were kind of like that. I liked poems that had an eerie effect. I was reading a lot of Wisła Szymborska and Jack Gilbert, who I think plays with big themes but within singular images. And then at some point I just kind of let loose, you know. And I think partly because my friend was like, "You're holding back." And, you know, the first real breakthrough was a poem called The Unknowing. This was a sort of long narrative poem that revolves around the idea that each generation gives up something that's kind of unknowable to the generation after.
Yeah, I
so
love
for my
that.
Grandfather, it was, you know, working endlessly through the depression and almost not having a family and emerging from the trauma of the earthquake and fire of San Francisco, and then giving my dad, you know, a practically happy days like childhood with a 57 Chevy and everything accompanying it. And then my dad knowing that in some obscure way the trauma that his father had emerged from and the sense of neglect that he grew up with because his father was so white-knuckledly hanging on to the life he had built that he passed this on to us in some unknowing way while giving us an even more ideal childhood. And I think that sort of cycle of unknowing is, to some degree, the upward migration story of many American families.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you just cannot imagine or fathom what your parents or your ancestors gave up.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of this book, once I was moving around more freely within it, it's me just imagining the lives of my ancestors. I know that my father's father's father was a baker in Grass Valley, California, but that he had come into the United States from England as a kind of religious refugee and lived in Canada and starved. His brother had starved to death, and he married his brother's wife. And I just, those stories are astonishing because it's the furthest thing from my life that I can ever imagine, and yet it is my family.
Hmm.
And I'm one of the hopes of this book is that by mapping experience on place and sort of moving the maps outward, it hopefully increases what is not rightly mine. I'm not thinking imperially about emotion here, but rather just the layers of self that extend beyond my body, that include my family and my ancestors, my imagined family, and then other people who I've known and loved, people like friends.
So beautiful. I wonder if it makes sense for you to read either Still Life or to read one of these poems, maybe a different one, because we've kind of talked about Still Life, and we can kind of deconstruct it a little bit and, you know, talk about the inception of the idea, maybe where it started.
You know, the one poem that emerged out of the failed project of writing about suburbia, and that is also a poem that emerged from a restriction, was this poem, Rocklin.
Uh-huh.
It's the first poem in the book, and I wrote it after returning from Oregon, and I had spent a couple days with Barry Lopez, partly for an interview, partly just to hang out. I have somehow become a friend of his, which is miraculous thing, because I love his work so much, and I admire not just the intensity of his ethical engagement with the world, but the beauty of it. And he and his wife put together this book of natural terms, and each term was defined by a different writer. So Butte is defined by a writer from Montana, and Arroyo from a writer from the Southwest.
Mm.
And I was reading through and just admiring the beauty of the words, and yet none of them applied to where I was from. And so I picked up a book on suburban sprawl, and I found all these terms in it. And I thought, hey, those are my terms.
Hmm.
And I basically upended the book and chose the terms I liked the most, and then thought, okay, I'll try to write a poem around these to say where I'm calling from. And I wrote it, and The New Yorker published it a couple years ago, and it's called Rockland. I can read it now.
It's great.
I saw it being built in the bowl of our foothills, trees disappearing month after month, replaced by smooth roads, empty schools, chopped up lots and cul-de-sacs, unfinished houses, sound berms, curving roads into long cement smiles. We drive there in our parents' cars, past starter castles to daisy wheel junctions, stoplights sheathed in muslin, swinging slowly in summer breeze, air so tight and piney you could hear construction hammering miles away. A ghost town, but for that sound. We'd sit in the unfinished high school stadium at the lip of what became the bleachers, a half-built multiplex in the distance, and listen to nothing turning into something, waiting for the sky to go purple, traffic to hush. Then, curfew looming, we'd race back across the newly edgeless city, radios cranked to drown our pounding hearts, tires whining on the silky arterials. We felt it would never end, the empty sky, the city that didn't matter, holding our breath when we clicked off the headlights and ran through stoplights.
Hmm. So pretty. I like the repetition of the stoplights. I noticed that the first time, the stoplight sheathed in muslin. And
it was like one of those towns out of The Walking Dead, you know, where it was being built all around us. And so my friends and I would go up and race around in our parents' cars because there was no one around. And yet it felt like a kind of stage set for, you know, the end of adolescence, I guess.
And it feels kind of post-apocalyptic, and yet it's really pre, right? It's being built, but it has this emptiness of something abandoned, and it hasn't happened yet. That's what I...
Yeah, and it hadn't happened yet, like most of our lives. And so it was like a stage set. Like there was all the outlines of the buildings or things that we would need in our life, but they were not inhabitable, including the houses. And you could even see where we were from this place.
Hmm. Sort of the if you build it, they will come poem.
Yeah, and the terms that I pulled out, I can see them like almost in boldface, but cul-de-sacs, chopped up lots, mm-hmm. sound berms, daisy wheel junctions.
Do all of these phrases arise organically from the poem, or when you're sitting in a coffee shop, do you say, oh my God, you know, here's a great phrase, mortuary silence of sleep's gravity, and then you write that down, and then you write a poem around it.
That one actually just came to me as I was writing that poem, because I had written most of the book, and I was starting to throw a lot of the poems out or put them to the side, and one of my friends who read it said, you know, you're not an unloving person, but there isn't really a love poem in here.
Hmm.
And so he basically challenged me to write a love poem, and it also became part of the, I hate this word, but it's the only word I think fits, that I had to kind of rebuild an epistemology after realizing that most of life is subtraction. You know, I think that's one effect that comes when you have lost someone so dear to you that the world itself doesn't seem to make sense. And I suddenly realized walking down the street one day that everyone I was walking by, because it was midtown and most people were middle-aged or a little bit younger, I thought, most of these people don't have a mother, you know, and they're functioning. They're walking to work. They're not, you know, they're buying coffees. They're going down into the subway. And it just seemed bizarre to me. So in addition to everyday life needing to kind of be recalibrated, I also had to come up with a notion of love, of romantic love that wasn't built from accretion,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was built from subtractions.
Hmm.
And that wasn't cynical or dark because of that. And so that phrase that you just mentioned is in one of the last poems, if not the last poem in the book. And I was finishing the book I was staying at a hotel in London, and I was just thinking about all the time I had spent alone whilst loving this person, you know, my partner, the person I share my life with. And, you know, the fact of that subtraction of hours together still managed to bring us closer.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, that's an elaborate way of saying that sometimes, you know, you don't spend time together and yet you like each other more, which is one of the luxuries I have of moving around a lot for work is I get to always feel the person I live with is fresh.
That's what I said was the key to my parents' marriage. Their absence of time together kept them
the Chekhovian marriage.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, we don't have children and we both work in the same industry. And so it could be really incestuous or it could be constant. And yet because I travel a lot, it means that there's always news and hopefully new things to share.
Right.
In addition to daily routines and doing the dishes.
Do you feel like the poetry teaches you something you didn't know, that when you finish a poem, you have an insight? A couple of poems here now, as I'm looking for them, I won't find them, but seemed to reveal something to you about your relationship or about the nature of love or about the stages of grief or something, that I wondered if the poem taught you something about life as a result of writing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was part of the... one of the big joys of writing the poems is finding out things I didn't know I knew, or that somehow the poem knew before I knew it.
Yeah.
Which sounds really mysterious, but here's an example. After my mom died, I went to Los Angeles to spend time with my older brother, and we drove around L.A., and we were both simultaneously obsessed with getting in a tattoo, because I think both of us felt there had to be some way to mark this experience so that, you know, maybe some barcode at least that just said me too, you know, not in the me too use of the phrase now, but just that I've lost my mother too. And it will sound extreme and weird unless maybe you've had this experience, but anyway, we started talking about it, and then we just started imagining, like, what is the appropriate tattoo. And I don't know where the conversation went, but I flew back from Los Angeles, and I sat down and quickly wrote the poem when I returned, and then saved it on the desktop of a computer in the house, and then just forgot about it. And at least five years later, I found it. You know, I think trying to get some files off the computer before it was donated, and it was like someone else's poem. I was reading it, and I thought, who wrote this thing? This is really weird. Because the poem kind of progresses through a series of elaborations on the tattoo, and like, how big can it be? And then ultimately it's like, what if I get a tattoo of her face on my face? Will that be enough? And the end of the poem concludes like, well, that's exactly what a face is. It is a kind of living memory of the people that you come from. And that, I don't recall writing that end line, but I remember writing the poem very quickly. And so the poem knew it before I did. That one of the eerie things, the eeriest thing about grief is that you are the walking reminder of who's lost, especially if you look in the mirror.
Right, right. You should be a poet, John. It's really good. Oh, we're drawing down on our time, but I wonder if you, I know this is hard to do, but if there are techniques, devices, things that you have learned over the course of writing this, like somebody was saying the term for juxtaposing these two ideas to create a third idea is a term called cutting. I had never heard of before, but I'm told that's true. Or listing things out, or certain things that have helped you craft your poetry.
Sure. There's a couple. One was I kept a word journal, just words that interested me. And you know, that poem I read called Rockland was a slight example of that. Another later in the book emerged from that, because I was starting to get suspicious of just how many new terms for soft target warfare there were, and how deprived our language was of natural terms. And the soft target war, you know, terrorism, they're all very bureaucratic terms, whereas the terminology of our natural environment is often very beautiful. And I thought, oh, God, why are we browning out some of the most beautiful parts of our language, let alone the pieces of our world that they represent, while we're developing this new technocratic language for warfare? So anyway, that one of the poems that's about that emerged from a word journal. Another one was, I feel like often titles of poems are kind of like tombstones. They just sort of sit there. And I started to, I ended up writing a series of poems, of which I kept maybe one, where the word was deeply embedded in the poem. So one was about saudade, which is a Portuguese word that I learned in Brazil, and its Brazilian meaning, which, among other things, is a kind of intense form of nostalgia that's beyond nostalgia. It's more like longing, as it was explained to me. And I wrote a poem about that, explaining it to an offstage listener in a kind of lyric. So that can sometimes work and get things started. Also for me, I don't know, some of your listeners, I suspect, spend a lot of time at their computers, at their iPhones. And I started probably in the middle of this book writing poems all by hand, because My handwriting is really bad, and it made it easy for me to not fuss in, too much over what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say you don't need to edit your poems. Of course you do, but I think sometimes the barrier is you write a few lines or one line, and then there's just all this white space sitting there. But if you're working on a notepad like I do, that's the size of the palm of your hand, and there's not a lot of shame.
Right.
The shame is like 3 inches by four. And so that to me ended up working very well in terms of just reducing the barrier to just getting something down.
Yeah, right. Your titles are so wonderful. I feel like a lot of poems take the title from something interior in the poem. And I mean, one or two cases did that, but really the titles in general brought a whole new layer and texture to the poem that wasn't there before, and kind of informed it in a new way. And I really, really appreciated that.
Thank you. No, that was definitely something I was trying to do.
Yeah.
It just felt like yet another word on the page that it sometimes can punch above its weight.
Yeah, I mean, poems have to do so much work, and every syllable counts. So, you know, if why waste a word by repeating it?
Exactly.
John Freeman, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's so nice to be here again.
I love it. And you have so much work out that I can have you on, you know, tomorrow you already have new work out that we can talk about. Well, thanks again. This was wonderful.
Thanks, Marie.
We are going to take a very, very short break. Please stay with me. We'll be right back.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads of almost 20 years of shows now, hundreds and hundreds of interviews, as well as information on upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward, onward. Jensen Beach is the author of For Out of the Heart Proceed. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, A Public Space, The Paris Review, Tin House, and elsewhere. He teaches in the BFA program at the Johnson State College and lives in Vermont. Swallowed by the Cold is the collection we're talking about this morning. It's published by the Great Gray Wolf Press. It is going to drive our discussion this morning. Jensen, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Marie.
I feel like there's a Florida story behind your name. Is that true?
Well, it is a city in Florida, but it's coincidental that's my name. My first and my middle name were both my grandmother's maiden names. So my maternal grandmother's maiden name was Jensen, and my paternal grandmother's maiden name is Waylon, which is my middle name.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, so I got both. But yeah, it is a city in Florida, and I visited a couple of times. I did some book events last year, right when the book came out in Florida. Every time I'm in Florida, I get asked that at a reading. Now, why'd you pick that as your pen name? You know, there's a city right up the road.
It's a good one, even if it's not your pen name. And it's not Swedish, so I want to.
No, it's not.
That's great. So just to orient our listeners, Swallowed by the Cold is a linked collection. It's 16 stories, some really pretty short and some longer, most all of them taking place in Sweden. And I'll kind of let you do the rest of the introducing. I did sort of the geographic introducing, but I'll let you do the territorial introducing and kind of what you were thinking about and the sort of organizing principles of the collection.
Sure. Just a second. Hold on.
Sure.
Sorry, my office door. I forgot to put a sign on that I was on the telephone. So I lived in Sweden for about 6.5 years, and I started writing this book right after I moved back to the United States to go to graduate school. And I had, so the stories for the most part are all set there. There is one story that's set in San Francisco, which is close to the part of California where I grew up. Mm. And the stories, I think, the geographical concern was my attempt, I think, to write about a place that I knew well and wanted, I missed. I think I was a little homesick for Sweden when I moved back and went to grad school at UMass in western Massachusetts. And I was feeling a little stuck with where I was going, the direction of my writing. I'd finished my first book. The collection was under contract. And this was, I guess, my second year of grad school. And then I was still writing some stories and trying to figure out kind of what I wanted, and I was sitting down with a writer whose work I've loved for a long time, Lars Gustafsson, a Swedish writer who died a couple years ago now. Mm. And I was just really drawn to the voice, and I thought, you know, I'm going to try to write about Sweden and my experiences of living there and these places, the summer house in particular, and some of the other locations in the book that seemed, I don't know, ripe for drama in a very personal way to me. And so I just started writing some Sweden stories, and then eventually it became a book.
I talk to so many writers who write about childhood, the places they grew up in childhood. And I, even though this is not that, I do feel mm-hmm. like there's some sort of, you know, nostalgia or wistfulness that when a writer moves away from a place that, you know, had particular meaning for them, it does kind of call you back. And I always wonder if it's easier to write about a place when you're not actually in it.
I think that's true, and it has always been for me. I wrote my first book when I was living in Sweden, and all those stories, it'd be hard to tell this unless you knew the places really well, but the stories are all set in the Bay Area where I grew up, and place is not really important, but it was just sort of incidental to the fact that, like, I was out of that space and living somewhere else and thinking about home and thinking about California and writing stories that were set there. And then I moved to Massachusetts, and I was writing about Sweden, and now I live in Vermont, and funnily enough, I'm working on a novel that's set partly in Florida and stories that are set in Vermont. So I don't know. I'm challenging my own notions of when I write about a place, I guess, by writing about it while I'm actually here, too. So.
And I don't know if it's the case. I've been to Sweden, but like for, you know, 48 hours or something. And I don't know if it's the case that it, because it feels so foreign to me, that the place and the weather, and, you know, I live in Southern California, so we literally don't have weather. It's just 72 degrees every day.
Yeah.
But the setting and the weather almost felt like characters in all of these, or a lot of these stories. And I don't know if that's a function of it just being foreign to me, so it felt exotic and different, or, you know, if that was your experience too, that these places really were kind of characters in and of themselves that functioned in the story.
Right. No, that's definitely true. I think weather, moving to Sweden was kind of shocking in that regard, because like you, I was in Northern California, which has a little bit more weather, but really it's essentially a weatherless place with few exceptions, maybe like the month of February or something. You have to go to the mountains to get any real weather if you're in California. But so moving to Sweden was sort of eye-opening in that sense. Like, there is real weather, and there's also lots of, like, time changes, and it's so far north that, you know, in the summer it stays light all night long, or almost, and in the winter it's really dark. The sun is, you know, the sun hasn't come up yet when you walk to work, and it's still dark when you walk home. So that's kind of those sorts of things were, there's maybe a heightened drama in that, but it did seem to be that weather and time and that sort of thing seemed important to me to get right in the book. And they do kind of take on the qualities of a character. I think the weather in particular in some of the stories generates a lot of the tension. And I think sometimes that's maybe a little bit of an easy trick, you know, and I think in a workshop an instructor might try to push against that and say, maybe you can gather that energy from other places. But I was kind of stubborn and really wanted to see what I could do with weather and see if I could, I don't know, make it appealing in that way and avoid the easy work that you know, the dark and stormy night stuff sometimes does for a piece of fiction, but instead kind of get at weather in a way that was real and true. Because weather, of course, when you live in a place that has dramatic weather, is enormously impactful and significant to our day-to-day lives. Right now, for example, on Sunday in Vermont, there's a huge windstorm that knocked down just thousands of trees, and I don't have power at my house probably until Saturday. So almost a week without electricity just because of weather. I mean, that doesn't happen. I guess it did just happen with the fires in California, but it was rare in my experience as a child growing up there that we had things like that happen.
No, exactly. And, you know, with environmental changes, it's happening more and more. That weather is creeping up, yeah. So, yeah, and you know, to your point about what a writing professor would tell you versus what you do, I mean, I think as I was reading these, I kind of had the same thought. And then I thought, you know, I mean, this is one of those great examples of knowing the rules and then knowing how to break the rules in a way that makes the story work in a new way. And I just thought it was really effective. Another one of those rules that struck me, the first story in here is really populated by a lot of people. It's kind of one of the longer stories, but I think I counted like 7 characters. And I thought, yeah, you know, any writing professor might say, well, 7 characters is a lot of weight for a short story to carry. But it didn't feel like that at all. I don't know how you did that.
Well, thanks for saying so. The other rule that story breaks is that, like, I kill the point of view character on the 8th page,
right,
or something.
Right.
I think I was just sort of, you know, early on when I was writing these stories, I think the draft of this book that was my MFA thesis is, there's maybe 20% of it left in the book that eventually sold to Grey Wolf and then my editor and I, Ethan Nosowski, worked on with me. And there's not very much left, but I think early on in the kind of germination of some of these stories, it was a process of me figuring out some of the different ways that stories could work and how they could operate structurally. And so I was at times failing dramatically at this, but really trying to do weird structural things. Like, okay, what happens if I just kill this character now and the story seems to maybe end, but that's not the whole story. I think there seems to be more of it. And so I wanted to keep going and like shift the focus onto the character of Henrik and see how that would be. I don't know. So I was playing with structure a lot and trying to, and not in a way that was sort of me necessarily being playful, but me in a way that was like trying to teach myself how some of the different ways in which stories could operate. As to the crowdedness of the story, I think in that story, in the first story in the book, and in a lot of the others, I was kind of also interested in exploring notions of like uncomfortableness and awkwardness. And as I started writing, and I very rarely plan out ahead of time what's going to happen in a story or who the characters are going to be. That changed a little bit later in some of the process with these stories because they are linked, and I sort of forced my hand a little bit to say, okay, I have to write a story featuring this character, and I have a vague sense of what needs to happen. But early on, I didn't know, and I just started writing this story. And the first story in the book was the first story I wrote, and I killed the Rolf character, and then I thought, okay, well, I've got this Henrik character, what do I do with him? And then I started to, you know, as I was writing, I put him and his wife in a summer house with, you know, Henrik's mistress and her husband, and I thought, oh, I can't think of a more uncomfortable situation if I tried, and it just seemed sort of interesting to jump into that a little bit and see the ways in which I could explore the humor of that and the tragedy of it and all of those elements.
Yeah. And I think that that story worked so well for a lot of reasons. But one of them is because it's a linked collection, you do kind of, you know, and it's kind of the orienting story where we get to meet a lot of the characters who we're going to meet further later in the collection. So I felt like it worked in that way, too. You could certainly read it independently, but it also, you know, informed the rest of the collection. So that was...
Yeah, and that became pretty early on, I think, even though that was the first story I wrote in the book. And I won't say I had a plan to write a book of stories and not linked stories necessarily. That came a little bit later in the generative process of putting these things together. But it became clear to me almost immediately once that process had started that story needed to be first, because it does sort of, it's a little bit anchoring or introductory. It does kind of provide just the... Background isn't the right word, but the sort of details of various characters that you need, I think, to unlock some of the other stories later on in the collection.
Exactly. My guest this morning is Jensen Beach. The book is Swallowed by the Cold, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. To the point about them being linked, I always think that linked stories are, you know, it's kind of like a big mobile, you know, and if you move one anchor of the mobile, the rest of the mobile is going to switch around. And I wondered if that presented any problems to you, that, you know, as you're exploring Louise, you're like, oh man, now she's an alcoholic and that screws this up over here. You know, I wonder, did you have any of those issues where one story's momentum or surprises then impacted other stories that you had to go back and adjust?
Yeah, there are quite a lot of moments where that sort of thing was happening, where let me see if I can try to think of a specific example, but maybe the story of the apartment that does feature Louise. She's also featured in the second story in the book called Kino, but that story is told from the point of view of her husband. After I wrote the apartment, the story, Louise's story in the book, I did have to go back to the Kino story and make some adjustments about how Louise might be acting, because I think the apartment sort of sympathizes with Louise in a way that that Kino does not, and vice versa. Martin is more sympathetic, I think, in Kino, and he's not necessarily in, at least maybe not until the end of the apartment. And so, I did have to go back and tweak and make some changes and have characters say certain things or act in ways that were suggestive or offered kind of echoes from story to story. So I had to start thinking about things in a way that was, I guess it's sort of metaphor for the way you need to think about story structure generally. It's not necessarily chronology, although it does sort of, it gives the illusion of chronology, but you have to think about it more holistically. You have to think about the beginning, middle, and the end kind of all at once, and how choices maybe early on in a story affect things later, and go back and make some changes. And the other thing that was hard was getting all the dates right on the calendar, because there's a couple of things in here in stories where I mention, like, you know, this was, you know, this date in particular, and it was a week before Easter, you know, like trying to figure out, because I knew I was writing the stories that are essentially taking place during the time that I'm writing it. So it's like 2009 to 2011. And so there's a lot of like figuring out, you know, what day Easter was on in 2009 and how that might inform things, or how much time has passed between some of the historical stories that are in the book and then the contemporary life of the book as well. And that actually was a lot of fun. I like thinking about that kind of stuff, you know, these great lists and, you know, mind maps of how things interact with each other and how dates match up and how, you know, character things that characters claim in one story are true because we see them enacted in another, and kind of making sense of all of those, that webbing and intersection was a lot of fun for me. Maybe not so much in the generative process because it was frustrating, but in the revisions process for sure it was fun to revisit all of that stuff.
And so what does that look like physically? What do those mental maps look like in your office? Do you have like a big whiteboard, or do you use Scrivener, or how do you like, you know, map it out so that you can see all of that stuff?
So what I was doing with these stories as I was writing them is some of the early ones were being workshopped, so I had hard copies of everything, and then that became kind of the habit that I got into with this book. So I would always, even when I wasn't workshopping stories, and most of the later stories in the book were written after I was in graduate school and I wasn't in a workshop in any sense. So I didn't have the need to print things out, but I would print hard drafts of stories out once I'd finished a draft, and then I'm a kind of, I read out loud too. I need to, I'm interested in sound and tonal quality. So once I've got a draft, I'm going through and reading things out loud and making notes for myself in the draft where I stumble and where, you know, things need to be pushed harder or revised or whatever. So I had a ton of paper, and I had just like, which is probably not an environmentally kind thing to admit to, but I had lots of drafts of the book in hard copy. And so I would make maps and lists and draw lines between character names and dates and things just on the backs of the hard copy of the book. And as that grew, I would save some of those and put them aside and then do away with certain things. And some of that was influenced too by the order in which I chose to put the story. So I'd settle on an order and then go through and make sure that the connections were making sense and then say, oh shoot, actually this story has to come before this other one, even if it doesn't chronologically come before it, it has to go here because what the action that this character engages in informs a reading of something that happens in a later story. Lots of notes.
Yeah, it's so interesting because this is a conversation I usually have with novelists, not short story writers.
Yeah.
Are you inching your way towards the novel in this?
I am. I've always loved the short story. That was the thing that I discovered first, that I think probably a lot of writers have this moment, and readers too, that thing, the genre or the type of text that you respond to, and there's that sort of visceral, like inside your body, kind of like tingle of pleasure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The short story was always the thing for me. I mean, I ever since I was a kid, I've loved short stories. I've loved the classic short stories that I had to read in high school English classes, and discovering short story writers and presses that put out lots of great stories, and I love teaching short stories. So I've always loved it. And when I first was writing, I would tell myself and sometimes other people that, you know, the short story is what I'll always just be a short story writer. I'm not interested in writing a novel. But actually this book and thinking about structure on larger terms has gotten me, this book's not novelistic in scope necessarily, but it's maybe novelistic in its structure or in the way it's sort of architectured together. And that has been kind of appealing to me. And I think maybe that sort of combined with the maturation process as an artist and as a teacher has kind of made me see the challenge of a novel as something that I am maybe ready to pursue. And I have been working on a novel for a long time, very, very slowly, as I also continue to write stories. So it's not really a market issue. I don't really care about, I've got a job. I don't need to write a novel necessarily. For me, it's more of an artistic concern and pursuit. So I am interested in it, and I am working on one.
That was going to be my follow-up question. I was like, is this coming from a conversation with an agent? Because I know they do that.
I'm lucky to have a very supportive and generous agent who does not pressure me and is, I think, more interested in working kind of longer term with me as an artist and as a writer and seeing what we can generate together. So she's not at all pressuring me to work on the novel, though I'd be happy for me to do so, I'm sure.
Well, that's a gift. That's a gift.
Yeah.
My guest this morning is Jensen Beach. The book is Swallowed by the Cold. So I'd love to just take one of these, whichever one you think is the smart one to take, and rip it apart. Talk about the original idea, talk about where it may have surprised you and taken a twist or a turn you didn't see, kind of your process of discovery. Anything you want to say about one of these stories from sort of, beginning kernel of idea to it's done, let's send it out. Does that make sense?
Okay, so I actually think the story I want to talk about is one of the longer stories in the book, Animals at Uneasy Rest.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
It's a story, it's kind of an outlier in the book because the character of the wife, Jenny, of course, does appear in other stories both as a focus and also a little bit tangentially, but the husband character, Jacob, the character in that story, doesn't appear again in the book. And I don't know. I really like that story a lot. It kind of, without getting too personal, I think it sort of betrays a lot of my own anxieties and the things that I stress about or think a lot about. I don't know. There's something about that story that I like. And so it started, it wasn't, when I started it, when I first drafted the story, it wasn't sectioned like it is now. It's numbered, and there are kind of chapters to the thing. And it became clear to me kind of early on that I needed something like that, some kind of structural possibility that allowed the story to jump and elide certain things, mm-hmm. But also, when necessary, follow a kind of tighter chronology. And so I could move kind of throughout this relationship with these two people and the things that Jacob is worried about and stressed about with a little bit more ease by allowing myself those jumps. This was one of the stories that I also knew, because of the car crash story, I needed to get... it was a story I wrote because I wanted to have a connection between the Jenny character and the Henrik character, who crashes his car earlier in the book.
Uh-huh.
And so this story, kind of unusually for me, was motivated by the larger concern of the book, not just because I, you know, latched onto an image or tone or a sentence or something that seemed exciting and full of potential, but it was actually, its motivations came from the need to fill in some beats in the book. And then it went through a lot of changes, and yeah, what else to say about it?
So it came chronologically in your own writing later on.
It did. Yeah. It's one of the later stories, and it's.
And did its writing affect the other stories that it was writing to address?
That's a good question. I don't know that it did necessarily, although there must be some kind of like factual things in the story. I think this is one also that dealt with some of the things with time that I maybe had to go back and tweak in some of the other stories, because I was trying to get the party that Jenny has been to is the same party that Louise and Martin are at earlier on in the book, and so I had to make sure that all the timing was right, and that can be... Those sorts of things were a little bit tricky. I had to make sure you get, like, weather and time and that sort of stuff right. So there might have been some small tweaks that I had to go back and make. But funnily, with this story, as I was sort of, as I was saying, its motivation was to kind of fill a plotting need in the book generally. I also found that the character of Jacob was one that I really responded to, just for kind of personal reason.
Yeah.
He deals with a lot of like health anxiety, and that was for a while something that I was also dealing with, and so he became a character that like allowed me to enact those feelings, and that's not something that I ordinarily do in my fiction. I mean, obviously my fiction is personal, right? That all mine is the only consciousness that I know, and so when I'm writing other people, they are all at least partly me, but that was a kind of new experience for me to be open about that stuff, even though I'm not directly saying as the author that this is me, you know, this is me being honest with you, reader. But I think
right.
Jacob was a character who kind of possesses some qualities that I was dealing with, for better or worse, around the time I was writing the story. So that, I think I kind of identify with the story even now.
Yeah, so good. I love the title, too. The title's fantastic. The title of all of these is fantastic. And it's not...
thanks.
The collection title often, I feel like, comes from one of the titles of the stories, and that's not the case here. So it's nice that this, you know, big global umbrella of what the book encompasses is also organic and, you know, something different than something that arose out of the book itself. That's really great.
Yeah, I had a sense... So the first story in the book, when I first wrote the draft of it, back in, gosh, it must have been 2009, I think, was called Don't Go, and which is a line that Rolf says when the sailboat is sailing away.
Yeah.
And there was something there about kind of, you know, that maybe was hinting at these notions of homesickness or of loss or movement away from. And so that was there. And for a while, the manuscript, as it was in the early stages of conceiving of this as a book, was also called Don't Go. But then I realized that that wasn't exactly, it was too narrow in its emotional approach. And I just happened to run across the Thomas Tranströmer poem about a death that the title is taken from. And I think the full line is something like names swallowed by the cold or something. It's like names in a phone book, I think, in the poem.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of immediately like turned the light on in my head, like, oh, of course, that's a perfect
that's
a perfect line to borrow. That's exactly what all of this is about, that sense of the kind of a little bit about the simulacra, about simulation, about fakeness and realness, and about loss and about authenticity. And I think a lot of those kind of thematic concerns, as much as it's appropriate for an author to say this about his own work, maybe make themselves available in the stories in various ways.
Right. It kills me, but we're out of time. Any 1 minute word of advice that you have? 30-second word of advice that you have for writers?
Well, this is what I always tell my students when I ask this. Be patient to yourself as writers and be kind to yourself as writers, and you'll get the good work done.
I love that. Jensen Beach, this was wonderful. You're all over online. I know you're on Facebook because now we're Facebook friends. You can pick up the collection now. The Apartment was printed in The New Yorker, so people can find that there if they have The New Yorker. But this collection, when read together, means so much more than any of the individual stories. So I really highly recommend picking this up. You were a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Jensen Beach. The book, Swallowed by the Cold, is out and available now. That's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.